I'd like now to welcome Jimmy Johnson. He is with the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, and he will be in Santa Fe this Sunday, May 17th at 6:30 at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation, sponsored by Another Jewish Voice of Santa Fe. So tell us about the group. Whose houses are being demolished, and where and why?
Well, we're the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, and we focus on the issue of house demolitions, but it's just kind of our broader window into the occupation generally. And the houses being demolished that we're talking about are Palestinian houses, and they're demolished for a few different reasons. The rarest type of demolition is where the house is demolished during an execution. Israel has a policy of targeted assassinations by which wanted or suspected Palestinians are extrajudicially executed. And sometimes this happens by collapsing a house on top of someone, which is a relatively rare thing, even in the context of the targeted assassination policy and in the context of house demolitions. It would be numerically insignificant to the both, although it's you can't minimize the trauma involved each time. The next rarest type is the one that most people know about, if they know about the issue at all, which is the punitive house demolition. And this is where the house is demolished because of the actions of someone associated with it. In the public mind, it's often associated with Palestinian militant attacks, including attacks on Israeli civilians or suicide bombings or things like this. Now, over half the houses demolished under this punitive house demolition policy were demolished prior to 1993, which is when the first suicide bombing happened, for example. But during the first Intifada, for example, you could have your house demolished for throwing rocks. Between 1967 and 1969, you could have your house demolished for simple political activity, after which you would be deported to Jordan. Now, but even if we take the example of Palestinian violence and in response to that, it's still a very difficult thing to justify, in the sense that if there was, for example, a suicide bombing, what would happen to demolishing that person's house is that you're trying to punish someone who's already dead. It's beyond the reach of punishment. And this is why it's called collective punishment. You're punishing someone else for that crime, and it's why it's forbidden under international law. The next most common type of house demolition, oh, just to be clear, these punitive house demolitions are around 8.5% of the number of houses demolished. Administrative demolitions are around 26% of all house demolitions. And this is where houses are demolished for a lack of a building permit. But the trick here is that it's almost impossible for Palestinians to get building permits. And then the most common type of house demolition is the land clearing operation or a military demolition. And this is where houses are demolished during some type of military activity or to reorient the infrastructure inside of a Palestinian area. For example, the 4,000 and change houses demolished during Operation Cast Lead in December and January, just recently, would be called military demolitions. But this policy of house demolitions is just one aspect of the occupation.
Where are these house demolitions taking place?
All over the place. It's there is no place where Palestinians live in actually either in Israel or inside the occupied territory in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, where houses are not threatened with demolition. The normal types of demolitions that we see in East Jerusalem are almost always administrative demolitions. In the West Bank, it would normally be administrative or military. And then in Gaza, these days, it tends to be normally military demolitions.
So it seems like you've got a lot of numbers. How many houses have been demolished, and when did this policy start?
Well, the policy started immediately after the 1967 war. In fact, part of it was being done during the ceasefire. To date, there's been over 24,149 houses demolished, I believe. And but during the Six-Day War in 1967, after Israel conquered Jerusalem from Jordan, inside the old city, there used to be something called the Mughrabi Quarter in Jerusalem's old city, or the Moroccan Quarter. And this was a neighborhood that was inside the old city near the Western Wall, or the Wailing Wall. And the entire neighborhood was demolished, some 145 homes, in order to make a plaza in front of the Wailing Wall to make it easier for religious people to go pray there. And so this policy of reorienting the infrastructure to suit the needs of the occupation or to suit the needs of an ethnocentric enterprise have been going on since the very beginning of the occupation. Although if we take a more historical perspective, the displacement of Palestinians actually begins in the 1947, 48, and 49 war, where hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were driven from their homes, and thousands upon thousands of houses were demolished then as well. It's where the refugees come from.
It is pretty ironic that you would demolish houses by the Wailing Wall. You'd have a lot more to wail about if your house was just destroyed.
It would seem so. It would seem so. But such a considerate worldview is rarely undertaken in military plans anywhere in the world, including Israel.
So what does the demolition look like? I take it this is something you've witnessed.
Yes. The demolition can take many different forms. If it's a military demolition, oftentimes you don't even know about the demolition until the bulldozers are on the way. And you hear it over loudspeakers, and you basically have to flee the house, hoping that you have time to get yourself out before the house is knocked over. During Operation Defensive Shield in Jenin, for example, there are several instances where people were not able to even remove themselves. With regards to administrative demolitions or punitive demolitions, normally what happens is that the army or the border police, or in the case of East Jerusalem, sometimes the municipal police force, surrounds the area with security personnel and then empties out the house of its people and other belongings and then proceeds to demolish it using excavating equipment.
And what happens to the people? They're outside with a bag maybe full of their possessions, and everything else they have is about to be destroyed for good. What happens to them? Where do they go?
Well, there's kind of two different ways to answer that question, I think. The first is, you know, with regards to where they go, they normally stay with family members. There is virtually no homelessness in Palestinian society because of very strong community connections. And so people do have a place to go, but this isn't always a positive development. The housing can be extremely overcrowded, and there are other concerns that go on there. But with regards to what happens to the family in a different aspect, it's an possibly traumatic experience and very difficult to imagine, in the sense that if you take the social construct of a home and what it means, it's the location of familiar objects. It's the personal place of refuge. It's the physical base of your relationship to everyone else in the community. And when the house is demolished and all your belongings are laid out on the street, that whole relationship is inverted. And any private space you had becomes public space. And you lose, and there's a very visceral sense of dislocation. It's much more than the destruction of, you know, bricks and tiles for the roof. It's in a very real sense the actual dislocation of your entire being. And it's especially traumatic to family units where you have a provider-dependent relationship. It's one of the basic parts of a provider-dependent relationship is food and shelter. And, for example, if children cannot depend on their parents for shelter and their parents cannot defend their shelter, it starts to tear apart that very organic relationship. And children grow up without that illusion of security that's, frankly, the children need.
We're talking to Jimmy Johnson, who is with the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions and who's going to be in Santa Fe this Sunday, May 17th at 6:30 at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation. Do the Israeli forces that are doing this have any pretense of providing any services or anything for these people whose lives they're pretty much wrecking?
Generally speaking, no. In the case of administrative demolitions, when houses are demolished for lack of a building permit, the perception is they're being punished, the Palestinians are being punished for breaking the zoning and planning laws, which is technically true, But the problem is that the zoning and planning laws are totally insufficient for the needs of the community and are organized in such a way that Palestinians cannot get these building permits. It's maybe not totally the right way to say that. The fundamental problem isn't that. The fundamental problem is the occupation. You know, but within the occupation, the reason that these houses are demolished is for lack of a building permit. With regards to the military demolitions, it's seen as kind of an inevitable part of war, this mass destruction of property, even when it violates international law, which the IDF, Israel Defense Forces, which the IDF itself recognizes. And in the case of punitive house demolitions, you're punishing the house of a terrorist, and that's how it's seen in the public mind. And so this humanitarian context is outside of the kind of worldview of the demolition itself.
I imagine that if, in the case of the punitive demolitions, somebody does a suicide bombing, or somebody throws a rock, or somebody does something, do they always get the right house when they decide that they're going to demolish it as a punishment?
I think they get the house that they're targeting, whether it's the house where that person lives, or a house where they stay the night before carrying out their attack, or something like that, is a different question. But I don't think that there's much for confusion there.
So it seems just so horribly violent. I'm thinking of how I would feel if it were my house. Is there, and I mean, to have even the slightest conscience, you would have to, I think, have some feelings about this. Is there resistance to this practice within the Israeli Jewish population?
Well, you've got groups like ours. You know, I mean, it's not just our group, but there's others like Rabbis for Human Rights, the Alternative Information Center, Bat Shalom, and the Women's Coalition for Peace. And, you know, there are people who speak out against these practices. But generally speaking, the way that it's perceived is that because of, well, maybe a way to talk about it is that the same zoning and planning laws in Jerusalem, for example, apply equally to the Jewish population as they do to the Palestinian population. But the Jewish population is in the community is organized differently. But the bureaucracy reflects the way that the Jewish community is organized. It doesn't reflect the way that the Palestinian community is organized, which would need a bureaucracy that suits its own needs and building habits and such. And so part of it is that you can't possibly see why Palestinians are building houses without building permits, because it works fine for us, you know? And so there's a whole lot of cognitive dissonance that doesn't quite get through to the to the Israeli public, because it's not seen as any type of violation. You know, that's seen as the criminals are the Palestinians. You know, or that of course stuff gets demolished during war. You know, what can you do during military attacks? It's unavoidable, and this is the way that it's commonly seen. And so it's not through some type of intended brutality, you know, where someone says, you know what, let's go to destroy a bunch of people's lives or something like that. It doesn't work like that at all. But it's just rather the way that the national consciousness in Israel is focused so strongly on this ethnocentrism that the considerations of the needs of the Palestinian community simply are not part of the discussion.
Are you from Israel?
No, I was born in the United States. I've lived there for 5 years.
And did you go there to get involved in activist politics?
Not really. I mean, to a certain degree, yes. Mostly I went there because that's where a relationship went.
And so you got involved with this group, which is a nonviolent group. What is the Israeli... I mean, we've talked on this show, and people talk about the difference between the Israeli Jewish population's diversity of opinion and the diversity or perhaps a little bit less diversity thereof in the American Jewish population. Talk about what you see in both places.
Well, to be sure, there's probably a broader range of opinion expressed in Israel than there generally is in the United States. Part of this, frankly, just makes sense, though. The issue is much closer to the Israeli press, for example, than it is in the United States. It's just one out of many global issues for Americans, whereas it's probably, along with Iran, the single the single most studied aspect of Israel's foreign relationships. You know, so it's in a way it's kind of to be expected. That said, the American Jewish community has kind of a different relationship with Israel than it tends to. And to be sure, I'm generalizing here, but I think it's a fair generalization. Has a different relationship with Israel than it has with other political positions. Groups like the AJC, for example, take very strong and very progressive and principled positions on a huge number of issues, everything from housing rights to immigration rights and various other things. But then when it comes to Israel, there's kind of a degree of partisanship, and it's not necessarily based on a set of ethics anymore, like many of the other political positions. Inside Israel, even if there is a broader degree of opinion expressed, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's equally represented inside Israeli society. Israeli society tends to be very depoliticized on this particular issue. Now, to be sure, there's a lot of political discussion, but it tends to revolve around, will it be Barak or Netanyahu or Livni or Lieberman who will, you know, provide the best security? It's not, you know, who will bring peace in negotiations. And so it tends to avoid the actual substance of the conflict, which is very similar to how things are in the United States, where people talk about the West versus the Muslim world or the West versus the Arab world, and generally don't talk very much about, you know, the actual substance of these conflicts, like neocolonialism and intrusions of Western capital and other similar things. And so the opinions inside of Israel, while much more diverse, don't necessarily reach a very broad public.
There's another dimension that I think is insufficiently talked about, which is the needless suffering, illness, and death of vulnerable people.
Well, sure. I mean, it's part of the very basis of the work that we do for our organization, amongst countless others.
So do you provide aid to people whose houses have been destroyed?
From time to time. I mean, it's not a key part of our work for a couple of reasons. One, we're not a humanitarian organization. As an occupying power, Israel has the responsibility to oversee the welfare of the occupied people. And we think that if we, one, assuming that we were able to raise the money to provide alternative housing, that would be a very expensive undertaking. But assuming that we were able to find this money, the problem that we would run into is that if we keep rebuilding everything that Israel destroys, then Israel has no incentive to stop destroying.
Right.
In a way, it goes to subsidize the occupation. And we see NGOs like this, non-governmental organizations, we see NGOs like this over the whole world, you know, that for all real purposes are subsidizing systems of injustice. And it's a very tricky situation with humanitarian aid. And so what we try to do is offer political solidarity. If there are ways that we can find to stop a house demolition before it happens, we try to do that. And in the long term, though, this political solidarity is what's actually needed to actually change the policy, not simply to keep rebuilding every house that gets demolished, which doesn't do anything to stop the actual demolition of houses.
So there are two pieces of that. One is trying to stop the actual demolition of an individual house in an individual moment, which might mean standing in front of bulldozers or whatever. And then the other is the larger policy change. How are you? Tell us about both aspects of that.
Well, the first part is almost never effective. We do direct action in civil disobedience as a matter of principle to make a statement of solidarity with our Palestinian sisters and brothers. But this doesn't mean that it's effective. What normally happens is when we're doing civil disobedience like that, like direct action, and whether it's standing in front of a house or helping to disassemble a checkpoint or whatever it happens to be, normally the soldiers will come pick us up, carry us outside the security perimeter, and then go to demolish the house. Or we'll take apart part of a checkpoint or part of the fence or the wall, and it will be immediately re-erected. And so it's we do it to make a statement of solidarity and then hopefully to make a fuss as well, to help raise the profile of the issue because it's the kind of stuff that media generally like. You know, they want something a little bit more flashy, and people standing in front of bulldozers tends to suit what they believe that they need to sell newspapers. And the broader policy part, though, this is the really important part. And it works on a few different levels. The main effort is you know, good communications with Palestinians, so that we can do proper solidarity organizing, and so that we can help further to whatever degree that we're capable the demands of the Palestinian community whose houses are threatened with demolition. And so, for example, there's a place in East Jerusalem called Silwan, and inside Silwan there's a little neighborhood called El Bustan. And the Palestinian community in El Bustan has been threatened with total demolition a couple of times now. The first time was in 2005, when the government declared their intent to build an archaeological park where several dozen Palestinian houses currently are. Could be as many as 105. But the community in Silwan is very highly organized, and they are very good at doing popular organizing. And so what we were able to do is just to try and provide our context with them, you know, our contacts in the diplomatic circle or in civil society, and so Palestinians could express themselves directly to them, because we're an Israeli group, we're not the voice of Palestinian liberation, you know. I mean, and so the type of solidarity that we do is, you know, we have our own positions as Israelis, and you know, about the occupation, about what we think the future should be. But if we're doing solidarity against the demolition of houses, it tends to, you know, take that Palestinian guidance. And because the Palestinian community there was so, you know, effective in doing their own outreach, that groups like ourselves and Ir Amim and Bat Shalom and others were able to help mobilize our own resources, and those houses were not demolished. Now, the government has recently re-announced plans after several years, because the international pressure grew too high, to demolish these houses again. And the same network that was there before is back in place. And it seems very likely that these houses won't be demolished, assuming that we're able to continue this pressure. And hopefully, with the relatively high profile of the issue of demolitions at the moment, raise the profile for not just this neighborhood, but demolitions generally speaking. And if we can do this in the framework of ending the occupation, then this could actually be a very strong momentum builder for further change, and perhaps quite rapid change.
What is your vision for ending the occupation? First, how to do it, and then what that region would look like afterwards?
Sure. Well, there's a few different ways that it could end. You know, there's basically any number of ways that it could end. But as a solidarity organization, we tend to look at, you know, what the Palestinian mainstream majority tends to talk about. Maybe mainstream is the wrong word, but let's say the Palestinian civil society majority. And so we've got, for example, documents like the 2005 call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions put out by an incredibly representative section of Palestinian civil society, which calls for a full Israeli withdrawal to the 1967 borders, full citizenship for Palestinian citizens of Israel, and then rights for refugees, the recognition of refugee rights for the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon and Syria and elsewhere. And so this is the type of, you know, this is what we support, you know, whatever basically the Palestinian civil society demands. Because we're not a nationalist group ourselves, and if Palestinian civil society switches to calling for a one-state solution, for one democratic state, then that's where we'd go as well. But again, you know, we can't really dictate the terms of Palestinian liberation, and so we tend to seek our guidance from things like the prisoners document and the boycott, divestment, sanctions document, and other similar things. Now, with what the future could look like, it could look all types of ways, and some of which could be very great, some of which could be very terrible. A lot of that depends on exactly what we do, since there is no predictive theory of history. Myself, yourself, and the listeners, you know, we're all agents in trying to shape this history. And so if we want the next chapters to be written in a positive manner, and where we have a true justice and sustainable peace, which can only come with justice, in the Middle East, it depends on what we do. It depends on how we mobilize our own communities, and it depends on how effective we are in forcing our own governments to change their policies, you know. And but there are very promising developments, like the Saudi peace plan, which offers Israel full recognition and integration into the region, as well as full liberation on the terms that at least the majority of Palestinians are talking about today. Again, a withdrawal to the 1967 borders and rights for refugees.
The United States obviously provides billions of dollars to Israel, and I don't know if there's really any strings attached with that money in terms of human rights stuff. It seems not. What can Americans do in terms of pressuring the United States, I mean, if not to withdraw that money, at least to recognize the rights of Palestinians?
Sure. Well, there's a whole lot of opportunity in the United States that could start with the U.S. simply upholding the laws it already has. There are things in the United States, like the Arms Export Control Act, that should dictate what types of arms are either sold or provided to Israel. And this might be, this if done properly, this could even have the potential to change American policy about militarized foreign aid, generally speaking. The only strings that normally come attached to such things, because of the non-enforcement of the U.S.'s own laws, are that the money has to be spent, generally speaking, with American arms companies. And so it's basically a U.S. taxpayer subsidy to Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and General Dynamics and others. But if this policy could be switched, because billions of dollars of this aid, Israel is the largest recipient, but it also goes to Colombia and to Egypt and Pakistan and Jordan and almost a who's who of human rights abusers.
Right.
If this policy could be ended, generally speaking, that would be a massive step in the civilization in the United States, as well as it would play a very strong role in changing Israel's own militarized policies. So that's one thing that Americans could do. Other things that the U.S. could do is to investigate groups like the World Zionist Organization and the Jewish National Fund, which have 501c3 status, tax-deductible status in the United States, but who are some of the most significant players in the whole settlement enterprise in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And why these blatant violations of international law receive tax-exempt status in the United States should be a stronger topic of discussion. And so these are just a couple of things that Americans could do. But at the end of the day, in places in New Mexico, for example, I wouldn't have the slightest clue about, you know, how this could be done, because I'm not from there. You know, people in New Mexico are experts in New Mexico and how to make change. And I rather suspect that the people in the community could come up with something far better than I could ever dream of. And so one of the questions I would guess is, how do you make the occupation a local issue in your community in Albuquerque or Santa Fe or Taos or wherever? You know, how
right.
is it going to, you know, what's the proper way to speak to your own community? And those are answers that I don't have.
Jimmy Johnson is with the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, and he will be in Santa Fe this Sunday, May 17th at 6:30 at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation, sponsored by Another Jewish Voice of Santa Fe. And you can find out more about the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions by going to ICAHD.org. Jimmy Johnson, thanks so much for being with us, and we look forward to seeing you on Sunday.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Brian Highhill and Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features a couple of good old-fashioned jam sessions. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.